If I'm brutally honest, I didn't know what I was doing at that point. It was an extremely difficult transition, go from the sell side business to the buy side. To be honest with you, it took me probably a good couple of years before I found my way. And then I had a good 2007, a very good 2008, very good 2009. And by that stage, I was managing 500 million. You know, I was like the typical obnoxious, aggressive kind of trader that I thought I would expect to be at Sullivan. And then when I left and I joined Brevan Howard, I remember my first impression was that the trading floor was like a library. I mean, really, so quiet. And the guys either side of it were just reading research boards. And I thought, well, you know, that's what I've got to do. I started reading stuff. And if you don't get the macro right, you're really not going to stand a chance. In the short term, you know, the relative value trades work out. But over the long run, if you don't get that macro right, you're going to get blown out of the sun. But if you want to make more than that, you've got to take some risk. And it's in the very nature of risk that occasionally you're going to get kicked in the teeth. So you have to be prepared. You've got to be prepared to have your ass handed to you. I like to see a lot of different opinions. And I think that is important as a macro trader. You need to form your own opinion. You know, what you can't do is just take a piece of research from your favorite investment bank and say, right, I'm going to follow their trade recommendations. They know what they're doing. They're good. Got to make your own opinion. Oh, yeah. Those words, shame, humiliation, are deep, intense feelings that one gets. I don't think the euphoria that you feel when something goes right compensates for the self-loathing. Because you always know, it's kind of like a roller coaster. Even when things are going well, you know that you're just, you know, a day away from getting hit again.
It was the legendary trader Stanley Druckenmiller who said, "I never use valuations to time the market. I use liquidity considerations and technical analysis for timing." Many of the greatest and most successful traders in history have used technical analysis in various forms to improve different aspects of how they engage with trading, the markets, and risk. That is why we are delighted to be sponsored by the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, a fantastic body which provides education and support for people developing their technical analysis skills. They provide superb educational content for traders serious about learning about price action techniques and methods and using it in either discretionary or systematic form to bolster their trading know-how and performance. At Alpha Mind, we are delighted to offer listeners a £100 or local currency equivalent discount on their superb home study course, which is based off their brilliant diploma program that has been delivered at some of the world's leading universities and written by some of the leading lights in the field of technical analysis. You can find out how to obtain this discount and apply for the home study course by visiting the link on our website, www.alpha-mind.net.
Johnny, welcome to the show, and perhaps give us a clue where it began. I'm particularly interested in where you suddenly realized that macro was your thing, and that was the driver for the way that you engage with the markets.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me on the show. It's quite an honor to be included. Certainly, yeah. I mean, shall I talk you through my career history and how it changed, or shall I just launch into my interest? Okay, all right. Well, I was very fortunate. I started at Salomon Brothers in the early 90s. And that was the tail end of the Liar's Poker era. And if anyone hasn't read that book, I can thoroughly recommend it. And Salomon's was still kind of like it was portrayed in that book. So I went on the training program for 4 months. I lived in New York, learned about bond maths, security valuations, and all this kind of stuff, and basically had a brilliant, brilliant time. And then I came back to London, and I got a job on the equity derivatives desk. Now, Salomon at the time was primarily a bond house, a bond trading house with big proprietary trading operation. The equity franchise was quite small, and derivatives at the time were just getting going. I mean, it was an immature market. So the desk was growing, it was expanding very, very quickly, and it was a wonderful opportunity. We would take quite big proprietary positions, and we were getting customer flow with very, very big margins. At the time, you know, I started off trading single stock over the counter options. Then I took over the FTSE 100 book. And at the time, the options were traded on life. The listed options were traded on life. There were no implied volatilities shown on Bloomberg. And I'm sure you know option prices, they're determined by fund to maturity and the strike price as a percentage of forward price. And the magic ingredient is implied volatility. That's what really gives the option the price. All this stuff wasn't transparent in those days. So we had very big bid offer spreads in what we were doing. And I made a market in FTSE options all the way out to 5 years, any strike from 50% of the spot to 200%, pretty much any strike. I did exotic products as well, barrier options, variant swaps, volatility swaps, capped volatility swaps, just about everything. And eventually I became head of that desk trading European products. And Salomon's went through quite a rough patch at the end of the 90s. Our Bond Arb desk were caught out with all the same trades as LTCM. They had everything that LTCM had on, probably in the same sort of size, crazy size. Salomon was in dire straits, and Warren Buffett at the time had owned a big chunk of Salomon and had lent money through preference shares, I believe. And Buffett delivered Salomon into the hands of Citigroup, basically. So we were taken over by Citigroup. And it was a very, very tough period for a couple of years because there were a lot of job losses. We were fighting for our jobs. There was an equity derivatives department in Citi. So we all were competing to keep our jobs. And then we had the dot-com boom bust. And the market really was quite difficult for a time. I had made money every year that I was there at Citigroup. And then as things improved in 2002, 2003, I just felt that I could do a lot better trading at a hedge fund. And the opportunity came up for me at Brevan Howard. Brevan Howard in 2004 was 2 years old. And I interviewed there with all the partners, and I was given the opportunity to join and become a portfolio manager. I think I started off managing about 100 million. And to be honest, if I'm brutally honest, I didn't know what I was doing at that point. It was an extremely difficult transition to go from the sell side of the business to the buy side. And to be honest with you, it took me probably a good couple of years before I found my way. And then I had a good 2007, a very good 2008, very good 2009. And by that stage, I was managing 500 million. And really, my focus moved more to macro. And I can talk about the reasons in more detail as we get going. But I stayed, you know, I moved out to Geneva with Brevan Howard. I lived there during the week, and I used to commute back on a Friday evening because my family stayed in London, and then fly back out on a Sunday. And that was bad enough. But I also had a few family issues, some personal problems. And by 2015, I just thought I can't stay in Switzerland any longer. I moved back to London, and I packed it in. And I did go to Graham Capital for a short while, but I lasted about 9 months there. It just wasn't for me, and that was it. And then I started trading for myself, but I found that by writing about the market, my trading improved dramatically, and I wish I'd known that while I was at Brevan Howard. So I started writing this newsletter, which I was doing for a broker, and the broker would send it to their clients, and trading for myself. And there's been an incredible improvement in the performance. I mean, since I opened this account 3 years ago, it's up 150%. I mean, if anybody really wants to see that, I can send the printout from Interactive Brokers. It really is quite an astonishing performance. So I'm now at the stage where I'm going to relaunch the note for a wider audience. It's going to be rebranded as Super Macro. And I hope to get that going by the end of the month.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That was a great introduction and a fascinating story. Hearing that, and there's something really jumped off the page at me. There's a few things I want to come back to in there that I want to ask, I suppose, out of curiosity and maybe out of curiosity for the audience who'll be listening. Something which just leapt off the page at me, because I'll be honest, I've been there. When you said, to be honest, I didn't know what I was doing. And I was listening to your story and it resonated deeply with me because, there's some similarities in my backstory. I never worked at a hedge fund, although I did work on the prop desk at Credit Suisse, which was like an internal hedge fund for a while. Not the one that Alan Harewood worked on, a different one in the investment banking arm. And I didn't know what I was doing when I went there. I know it sounds crazy. I'd been mostly involved in either market making or some aspect of market making, like arbitrage, where you're running books and you're trading across products and you're taking the value out of the product. And I'd become pretty adept at it, but I kind of lost a bit of interest in it, particularly as margins came in. It required harder work, and I was quite adverse to hard work. So I kind of also developed a fascination for sort of developing or directional trading, taking views and then putting on risk. And I think partly as a result of being successful at that, they moved me to this experimental prop desk, which was like a hedge fund. And they said, you can trade whatever you want. You know, they didn't give us capital as such, but they said, you know, here's your risk levels. There's almost no limits. Trade what you want. And I thought, well, this is great. I can have fun. I really didn't know what I was doing. I was trading products and markets I knew nothing about, and did a really good job at losing money at them.
That's the only way you learn.
Which, but I managed to lose a lot of money. So I learned a lot. But I really got that. And then, you know, I had another kind of moment later in my career when I said I was about 13 years into my career. And I've spoken about this before. I started working with a coach, which was pure luck. It was an experiment being run by the bank. I was at Commerzbank at the time, the German bank. And I was put into this program. I didn't know why I was there. And that's when I really realized or really learned I knew nothing about what I did and who I was when I was doing it. And actually, that was the big revelation for me. And my trading got a lot better after that. And in a way, that's kind of started the journey of why I'm here now, how I met Mark, how we started AlphaMind, you know, nearly 20 years later. Because, you know, that is something I hear all the time from people. You know, I hear it from people in hedge funds, banks, retail traders. You know, people have been doing it many years. And there's this constant, like, evolving set of revelations people have where they realize that, I don't really know what I'm doing.
Well, yeah, I can elaborate. I mean, when I was effectively a market maker, I did have a pretty good work ethic, and it was kind of early days for the derivatives markets, and I really wanted to give myself the strongest competitive edge I could. So I actually went back to my engineering maths books, relearned my maths. I mean, this took me couple of years. I relearned my maths so that I could model volatility surface. You know, each option maturity and each strike has an individual implied volatility, and it's like a two-dimensional And as market makers at the time, we would just sort of nudge up the volatilities to different maturities, change the skew, you know, the what extra volatility we put in for out the money puts versus out the money calls. And we had it was kind of a manual process, and I wanted to be able to fit curves through that, mathematical curves that were based on some sort of science. So, you know, I really spent a lot of time doing that, and I thought I was doing a pretty good job. But it like you say, Steve, you know, as a market maker, all you really need to do is really understand the flows and make sure you know where everything's trading. Don't let yourself get caught out. And the other thing is that I think I was kidding myself that I was just this brilliant trader with a great instinct for taking proprietary positions, because at that time, you know, we had a decent customer franchise, you know, by the early 2000s. And there was still pretty good margin in the products. So in any month, you had this customer flow, good margin, that was generating a certain amount of P&L. And behind that, one could do one's own sort of proprietary punting. And typically, typically this involved options. And as you know, with options, you know, you're battling against the time decay. But if you've got the customer flow business that's generating some P&L on top of that, you're going to, in a bad month, you're going to probably come out even or slightly down on the month. In a good month, when it all kicks off, you're going to make a hell of a, you know, just a boatload of money. And you're going to sit back and think to yourself, wow, I'm such a genius. I should be in a hedge fund. And that was, you know, that was how it went for me. And, you know, I was like the typical obnoxious, aggressive kind of trader that I thought I was expected to be at Sullivan's. And then when I left and I joined Brevan Howard, I remember my first impression was that the trading floor was like a library. I mean, really, it was so quiet. And the guys either side of me were just reading research reports. And I thought, well, you know, that's what I've got to do. I started reading this stuff. And, you know, a lot of it was so boring. I just was going out of my mind. And that was when I was thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing here? But I started to do the type of trades that I've kind of become familiar with. I was doing relative value, volatility relative value arbitrage trades. So, for example, you know, on the Nikkei, typically the realized volatility on that index was between 2 and 4 points above the realized volatility of the S&P. And I was doing trades where I would try to capture the Nikkei volatility at a discount to where I was actually selling the S&P volatility by using a combination of variance swaps, you know, with a longer maturity or whatever it was, all this kind of clever relative value stuff. That's what I focused on. Plus some correlation trades where it's what we call a dispersion trade. You know, you buy you effectively buy the volatility on every stock in an index and sell the volatility of the index, and you hope that half the stocks move up and half the stocks move down on any one day, and the index doesn't move. But that's the kind of trade. And then I began to take more and more of an interest in macro. And when 2007 came, you know, people don't remember this, but there was a kind of interbank funding crisis in August of that year. You know, there was this, what they call the TED spread. It's the Eurodollar rates versus the T-bill rates, the 3-month Eurodollar versus 3-month Treasury bill. And it's an indication of bank funding stress. And that blew out in August. I think at the time, subprime was acknowledged to be a problem, but it was perceived to be very well contained. I think one or two of the mortgage brokers had gone belly up, and things were starting to unravel. Now, at the time, I think the Fed, I believe from memory, the Fed cut the discount rate or they took some emergency measures to stabilize the market, which succeeded. But I remember very clearly, I've been on vacation in America when this all kicked off, and I felt sick to my stomach because I felt there I was, you know, this maestro volatility trader. The markets were becoming incredibly dislocated and volatile. And if anything, I was losing money from all these relative value trades. Because when things go awry, the relative value trades just blow up. Somehow there's some tail risk in all of them that just goes bad. And actually, I do remember being at a hotel and throwing up. I just felt so sick to my stomach at what a mess I'd made of things. Well, that's how I felt. Now, things stabilized, and I came back to London, and the market started to rally. And in fact, it rallied towards the end of that year. And I knew, beyond any shadow of doubt, that 2008 was just going to be a diabolical year. And I had to be just outright long of volatility, short the market. I just had to be ready for that disaster scenario. And it kind of made me realize that you've got to take account of the macro considerations primarily. They supersede all other considerations. If you don't get the macro right, you're really not going to stand a chance. In the short term, you know, the relative value trades can work out. But over the long run, if you don't get that macro right, you're going to get blown out of the water. And so from 2008 on, I was really, really focused on macro. And my mandate expanded. Instead of just doing equity derivatives, I started doing quite a bit of FX and then fixed income, credit, and just about everything else. But certainly, I mean, to your point, the transition from sell side to the buy side of the market, for me, certainly wasn't straightforward.
We're going to return to this great podcast in a minute. We just want to tell you a little bit about AlphaMind and our powerful trader performance coaching and high performance workshops, which help people and teams to unleash their full potential in markets. The performance coaching helps traders and risk professionals to break through performance ceilings, whilst our powerful workshop programs delivered inside major trading businesses specialize in bringing groups of people together and empowering them as traders, risk professionals and people who work with the traders to reach new heights as teams and as individuals and to help master the performance aspects of trading. If you would like to know more, visit our website at alpha-mind.net or email us info@alpha-mind.net. Now let's get back to the podcast.
I just want to pick up on the word macro. It's a big word, right? It's a very broad remit in terms of what macro means. And I'd be very interested to hear from your own view, because of course you're a storyteller through the research you do, and you're writing about the market as such. But what in particular do you look at in macro? It's so broad. Are there things that you stick to? Are there things that you've tried and you now avoid because maybe the sensitivity is wrong or something? And actually, do you shift the macro lens actually as a trade or a market you're looking at sort of changes? Do you shift the macro, or do you still stay with the, you know, the original intent of what your macro view was at the start of the journey?
No, I think you're absolutely right there, Mark. The market itself can't focus on too many different things. So the market really starts with the US. Macro considerations start there. Interest rate policy, fiscal policy, and so on. But periodically, the market's focus will move elsewhere. Now, it could be China, other emerging markets, it could be Europe, it could be Japan. And I think it's, for a lot of the time, I try to focus on the major economic region. So it'll be the US and Europe. and to some extent the UK. I really don't spend a great deal of time focusing on emerging markets because I think they're almost, they have their own idiosyncrasies, and they have their own stories, and to some extent you've got to be a bit of an insider there. So I stick with the major markets. But they, you know, from time to time, you'll find there is a story developing in one particular region. You know, it, for example, in Europe, obviously it's the sovereign debt crisis. In Japan, when it was what we call the Japan trade, when Abe got elected and brought in Kuroda, and you know, he had this three arrows policy. It's going to do fiscal stimulus, an extremely strong burst of monetary stimulus, and encourage corporate reform. And I think the whole story seemed to be very, very powerful at the time. Of course, with hindsight, we know it took probably the best part of a decade to really bear fruit. It was only in the last couple of years that we've seen inflation pick up in Japan. But at the time, it was a story that made a lot of sense to me. And in fact, not only to me, I knew that it would make a lot of sense to the rest of the macro community. And I think that's one of the key things, is that when you're looking at the macro, you've got to also ask yourself, is it already consensus? And is it already reflected in current market prices? Is what I'm seeing something new? And so for me, I subscribe to Oxford Economics, Pantheon Economics, Peter Bupa. I read from a lot of different sources because I do like to read opinions that are opposed to my opinion. I like to see a lot of different opinions. And I think that is important as a macro trader. You need to form your own opinions. You know, what you can't do is just take a piece of research from your favorite investment bank and say, right, I'm going to follow their trade recommendations. They know what they're doing. They're pretty good. You've got to make your own opinion. And you've got to source that from as broad an array as possible. So that's why I suppose that's why I first started trying to replicate the charts that I saw in other people's research. You know, I've got Bloomberg and I use Excel and I take in the Bloomberg data feeds and originally I started replicating other people's charts to just teach myself how to manipulate the data. And then the more that I did of that, the more I could better analyze the data myself and form my own opinions. So I think that's the way you've got to manage macro. And I can give some just great examples of some great macro trades over the years where, you know, if you're early on in the trade, and it's a story that you think is really going to get picked up by the rest of the community, you can really make a lot of money. And then perhaps, you know, you can use your experience and your trading knowledge of a specific product, like, for example, options, implied volatility and so on, to structure the best trade to suit your idea.
But when has macro actually tripped you up and been a surprise?
Well, that actually brings me on to another point that I found. Many traders may be vulnerable to. I was at Brevan Howard. We had some really, really clever, brilliant economists. UK economist went to work for the Bank of England, was one of the MPC members, and he was great. I could ask him anything when he was there at Brevan Howard. He'd explain it to me. Regardless of how stupid the question, Jason Cummings, head of research and an ex-Fed staffer, also another brilliant guy. But the problem I realised is that psychologically, when you're at a hedge fund like that, surrounded by a lot of very clever people and very well-qualified people, one tends to overweight the opinions of those people. You know, that's the Brevin Howard opinion. He's a Brevin Howard economist. He must be right. You know, I'm going to follow what he says. I might actually give you a prime example of that in, I think, 2010, 2011. You know, the economy was, the US economy was kind of struggling to really get going, and the Fed kept implying that rates were going to go higher. You know, the forward guidance was that rates were going to go higher. They were going to be hiking rates. Now, at the time, the market didn't really believe that. The Fed funds futures, short-term treasuries, they weren't priced for higher rates. So there was potentially an opportunity there. Now, our economists, who were ex-Fed guys, they bought into the Fed story that the US economy was really picking up, they're going to have to hike rates and so on. And so the trade was always, or for quite some while then, to position yourself for higher US rates. Now, there are a couple of ways of doing that. You can, at the time, my favorite strategy was to be long dollars against sterling and the euro, and then it moved on to being long dollar yen. And I had a very big position in dollar yen because the rate differentials with Japan were going to widen out. The US was going to hike, in theory, Japan was going to stay where it was, and so this should support the dollar. And I remember throughout this time, you know, I was scaling up the position as it went my way, and then there'd be a setback, and then I'd do it again, and then I'd hear from, I remember the US economist, we should really be scaling up this position, Fed's going to do this, the Fed's going to do that. And I remember thinking, yeah, I better scale up my position a bit more, and then it would drop again. And then I remember coming towards the end of that year, I think it must have been 2010, in October of 2010, and within about a month, I'd lost a lot, you know, straight back down to zero. So the macro or one's own consideration of the macro can just be wrong.
It's a fascinating thing because I think, like Mark asked, what does macro mean? It's a term that everyone knows, but I think there's so much nuance to it. You know, whether, you know, future data is fully discounted, but you also have to bring into account, you know, things like liquidity, market positioning, sentiment, all those aspects. And I think you probably sort of labeled that quite right when you were just talking about that 2010 position, that, you know, there's probably a lot of sentiment behind that idea of getting longer of the position, but also the market doesn't always follow through, as we know, especially if everyone's long.
Well, I think a classic example was in 2013, you know, with the Japan trade. And I'd had a bad 2012, my worst year, trading year ever. I lost 4%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it was pretty painful. And so I shut everything down. I went out to New York with my wife for a week and just spent some time meeting with investors and just not trading and meeting with some of the guys that at investment banks, the analysts, the traders, just trying to really form a picture of what makes sense. And it was at that time that I became aware of what was going on in Japan and felt that this could be a huge trade. But, you know, having had such a bad year in 2012, I started off quite cautiously. And as 2013 got going, scaled up and up and up, the trade got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was always very, very careful to make sure I had options that would get me out the position effectively on a setback of about 10% in the Nikkei. And for dollar yen, it was a similar sort of thing. Most of the exposure was through options. And if there was a pullback, I'd be out the trade. And I mean, the whole firm was getting so excited about this Japan trade, and so were a few other hedge funds at the time. And I remember coming in one morning, and there was a guy, I'm not going to mention his name, but he'd always been a hater of equities. He came in one morning and he said, look, you know, I've got into this Nikkei trade. I think it's a no-brainer. And, you know, I started questioning him about it, and he told me what he'd done. And it was the most insane size. You know, I've been pretty cautious throughout this, and he just put on a trade. It was more than 10 times the exposure that I had. And for the next 2 days, the Nikkei went up about 4%. And then there was the most almighty setback. There was an almighty washout. I gave back a chunk of P&L, but then I was out the trade from the options. He lost his job, this particular guy. He lost a fortune. And it showed me that part of the trade was, yeah, the macro makes sense, but a large part of the trade was actually, it was just more and more people jumping on the bandwagon. It's a bit like these meme stocks in 2020. You know, regardless of whether it made sense or not, more and more people kept buying into them, and the price kept going higher and higher and higher. And so for the Japan trade at the time, it was kind of like that. It was more and more people coming into the trade until all of a sudden one day the music stops and there's a massive washout. And that's why I think for me, I've always been quite cautious to protect the downside, the tail risk. You mentioned just earlier, Steve, the treasury trade. I started writing about this 18 months ago, and started writing about how I was building up a short position in treasuries when the yield was 1.2%, 1.5%. You know, I got really, really short and have traded it quite aggressively all the way. But now I'm at the point where we could be at a point of inflection. I don't know. Maybe the 10-year treasury yield goes all the way to 5% and through. Or maybe there's a setback. I don't know. But I am positioning myself with a smaller delta now, and I'm covering the risk with options, because it doesn't matter what your macro opinion is. You've got to be prepared for a setback, especially when it's a very, very well-subscribed trade.
And, your preference, is it a case that you tend to have this blend of, you know, the sort of the futures, the outright, or, you know, sort of cash side, a derivative equivalent, or an option? Have you found any one of those in particular, or do you generally approach it through a blended approach?
Well, it's I kind of alluded to this earlier. What I try to do is look for the best way to exploit the opportunity given the market pricing of options, and in that sense, I mean the implied volatilities and the payoff that one might get from, say, a call spread or a put spread or an outright position protected with options and so on. I like to, you know, implied volatilities are quite complicated things, and pricing options that way, but I like to do it on a very, very simple basis. And for example, if I want to take a short position in the S&P, I have a grid, an options grid of maturities and strikes. And I often like to find a short-dated put spread that might give me a payoff. I have on the grid the payoff from different put spreads. I might say, for example, set the spread between the two strikes at, say, 50 or 100 S&P points, and look at how far out the money I have to go with these two options to get a payoff of 10 to 1 or 8 to 1 or whatever it is. So I like to simplify what it is that I'm doing to a situation where I've got a simple payoff. If I find that the option market pricing is prohibitive, that just doesn't make sense. You know, you're not really getting much bang for your buck, but by using the options, then I'll have to take a smaller outright position in the delta, in the underlying. So that's how I tried to do it. But by the same token, a macro opinion can be expressed in a number of different ways.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point I think you make, particularly given that we've got an audience that people might be fairly new to coming into trading. There'll be those more in the retail. But I think you make an extremely good point about being bothered to understand the various flavors that are available and you know, educating yourself to what those flavors are and perhaps the question of whether they are accessible to you, you know, which they may not be at all in some cases. But if they are, of course, understanding those flavors so that you can get the best strategy for, you know, the various surfaces that we know are out there and that there are markets within markets. And perhaps those that are at the professional side of the business can take full advantage of the fact that there's arbitrageability within the market, and of course within the product and the various surfaces. Understanding that as a perhaps a macro trading view in terms of that portfolio is hugely advantageous. And so, you know, if you are a trader coming to the market, understanding that you know, broadening your learning, you alluded to, you know, reading far broader research perhaps than you read at the moment to understand how you can put risk on in the various ways. I think it's really, really important. I think if you're going to get anything out of the market, I think you do need to have a sense of what that palette is and what it looks like, and what if your risk is allowed to be put into the various parts of that palette, and of course, then how are you going to manage it once you've got the risk on? So yeah, it's great that you covered that, because I think there's a lot of people out there that would think, hang on, there's a bit more to this than I thought.
I think as Steve mentioned earlier, you know, didn't really know what he was doing with some of the products he was trading. That's not such a bad thing. You've got to get your hands dirty. I mean, if you think, okay, I think what Johnny Matthews was saying makes sense. I want a short Chinese currency. Well, there are CNH futures you can trade. Now, you might think, well, I don't really know anything about those. But, you know, you can read the product definition from the exchange. You can find out, you know, what the exposure is per tick and so on. And the best thing is just put a small trade on and see what happens. Read what you can about the product, put the trade on, see what happens. You know, maybe you lose some money, but, you know, it's a good learning experience. That's the price you've got to pay. And that's how you build up some sort of some more product knowledge in areas that you're not familiar with. I remember the first time I traded a JGB future, Japanese government bond future. This was back in 2001 or 2002. And I thought back then, you know, the yield was far too low. And I shorted it. I shorted one future, which is actually quite a big contract. And I did quite well. And then I think I had to roll the future. You know, the June expiry was coming up and I had to roll it into September. And for some reason, I don't know what was going on, something in the repo rate. I really didn't understand what I was doing at the time. I rolled the thing and it seemed like all my P&L within a few weeks had just gone. I just really effectively paid the wrong price for the roll and the P&L vanished. And I got out the trade and just said to myself, you know, this is not for me. I'm not going to touch it again. And I haven't actually.
What you're saying there brings me on to sort of, I wanted to shift the angle of the conversation slightly towards this human aspect of trading. Because you said something really interesting. You said that when you started writing for other people, you found yourself trading far better. And you suggested that as really good advice. for other people listening. What did that do for you? You wish you'd have done it many years earlier, okay, which of course I get. What did that do for you? What was happening for you when you were doing that?
There's so many things, Steve. I mean, honestly, if I think of all the emotions that crept into my trading, the boredom trades, and all the bad mistakes that I made over the years, and regardless of how disciplined you might be, in a kind of dull market, one does get tempted to having punts. You know, thinking that one sees something in the way something's trading and just having a punt to pass the time of day. Once I started writing, I didn't do any more of those boredom trades, should we say. I was just focused on doing the research, coming up with some sensible ideas, trying to justify them, and explaining myself in the newsletter. And often I would go for days and days and days without putting a trade on. Just writing the newsletter completely occupied me. And then when I did have a trade on, I was okay to sit with it. I mean, obviously, I have stop losses and I'm able to manage the position, but the emotions were taken completely out of the trade. It was a kind of almost a secondary importance. I was just busy writing the note and doing the research. And I found it's been so much better. My trading style has evolved much better than it ever was. My worst year at Brevan Howard in 2012, I mean, aside from the family issues, the problems that I had, it was also a year where I'd taken on someone to work for me, very clever guy, and I'd given him loads of research to do and look at this, you know, volatility spread, look at this currency, look at that. And every time he did all the research, I felt obliged to put on a trade to just sort of keep him motivated. Terrible reason for doing a trade. And so, really awful. I was doing a lot of these small trades that were just bleeding money month in, month out. And I let him go at the end of the year. That's a whole other story. That was a very unpleasant experience. But anyway, like I said, I went off to New York and just cleared my head and got back to focusing on the big picture. But I think when it comes to trading, you do have to leave your emotions at the door. You mustn't be impulsive. I think you've got to also have a tolerance for risk. You've got to understand that you've got a choice. You can put your money in the risk-free rate, like, for example, in the States, you know, you can get 5% a year for 2 years, no risk, absolutely risk-free. But if you want to make more than that, you've got to take some risk. And it's in the very nature of risk that occasionally you're going to get kicked in the teeth. So you have to be prepared. You've got to be prepared to have your ass handed to you.
Yeah, you said something really ironic there, which is that paradox that you've got to leave your emotions at the door. I don't know anyone who's ever got kicked in the teeth and not been emotional about it. It's the nature of risk, okay? It's going to upset you. And that's the big challenge about this job. You know, I'm sitting here with one of my clients' journals in front of me at the moment, and this guy's been trading well over 30 years. I know the guy. He's an extraordinary trader. If you read his journal, you just think that the guy's the biggest loser in the world. And he talks about shame and humiliation. Yeah. And you know, it just reads like a whole depressive manual. And it's, I think you can only understand that if you've done this for so many years, you know, that.
It is that those words, shame, humiliation, are deep, intense feelings that one gets after a losing period, because with hindsight, it was so obvious what the correct course of action was. And you, like an idiot, you know, didn't do it, and now you're nursing a great big loss. And I remember many times in my career just hating, being full of self-loathing and hatred and just Absolutely. If I'd had a gun at hand, I probably would have blown my brains out. Honestly, it's that deep a feeling.
I don't know, but I can't imagine a job which creates so much self-loathing as trading. You know.
I don't think the euphoria that you feel when something goes right compensates for the self-loathing. Because you always know it's kind of like a roller coaster. Even when things are going well, you know that you're just a day away from getting hit again. I mean, it's so you can never really enjoy it. But I found the distraction of writing, the distraction of researching and writing, has made it much easier for me to bear these thoughts now.
You know,
it's
true. You know, because what that reminded me of in the early days of my developing myself as a coach, learning coaching, going through programs, and then trying to build a coaching business. I was still trading. I'll be honest, I've never quite stopped trading, but it's always been a hobby more than, you know, it's the losses are so small they still hurt funny. They still hurt, funny enough, even though the monetary side is irrelevant. But I was asked by some friends who had a technical analysis business, and they wrote analysis which they sold to clients, banks, etc. They asked if I could do some of the analysis for them for a few months till they got somebody else in, because they'd lost one of their team. And I agreed to do that. You know, I had the time on my hands. I wasn't busy. So I was getting up early, writing this analysis. And I found myself making really good market calls and started trading some markets which I had to analyze that I wasn't normally trading, particularly Scandi crosses against the euro. And I was making a lot of money on it. And that's where you reminded me there. I did that earlier in my career where I used to write out my views on the markets as if I was an analyst. I'd pull everything together, fundamental, macro, gut feel, technical analysis. I'd pull everything together, sentiment analysis, and I'd just write a view on where I thought the market was going. And then I kind of had this idea where I had two hats on. One was to be this analyst writing their market views. And then I would change my hat and give it to me as the trader, who was just the risk taker who had to execute, which was the hard part, as you know. But I was far more successful during that period as well. And it may be that was part of it as well, writing it down and trying to keep the emotion and the ego out of it by writing it down in that way. So that it was then just for me to execute.
Well, I think it gives you a greater confidence in the trade and greater commitment to the trade. And one can justify in one's own mind why one has the trade on in the first place. And then if it goes wrong, you know, you can say, well, okay, I got this wrong, but this is part of risk taking. And not feel, for me, not feel quite so bad. You know, I kind of expect that my trades, I will have bad weeks from time to time. But it just doesn't bother me like it used to. I write and write and write, and I've got good ideas for why the trade should work, why I've got them on. I've got the justifications all written out. But I'm fully aware that sometimes, regardless of how good your macro analysis is, depending on market positioning, depending on whether the trade is already fully subscribed and a variety of other factors you can't necessarily know in advance, it's very easy for there to be setbacks. But I just accept that. You know, it really doesn't faze me like it used to. And the other thing is that I know now that the trades that I put on with a good reason. I mean, there's been times. I mean, when I first started trading for myself outside of broker account and anything else, one of the things that I really quite liked was gold. I thought, okay, we're going into an inflationary era, gold must do well, and I started trading gold. And then I had one of those big setbacks. I wasn't writing about things at the time, and I started revenge trading.
Oh.
If you know what that is.
Yes.
And this is like the most diabolical thing you can do. And then every time you put a trade on, you have no commitment to it. It goes wrong and you cut it, and then straight away it reverses. And you think, oh, I was right the first time, or it reverses and you think, right, I'm getting on that, and you get on that. And I just remember blowing through, I blew through $3,000 in a day just punting around in gold futures like an absolute idiot until I realized what I was doing, just shut the screen off and left my office and went home.
The revenge trade is the ultimate ego trade. You know, I mean, who are you taking revenge on? It's you. It's yourself.
Exactly. There's nothing worse.
I don't think in the history of trading, over how many, you know, thousands or millions of people trade, that anyone's ever made money with a revenge trade.
It's pretty difficult. I mean, it really is difficult. But I, thankfully, the writing helps me avoid that kind of stuff, those kind of emotions that might lead one to want to do that.
Yeah, so it's interesting because there is no sort of signal which appears on the screen that goes, you're doing a revenge trade, idiot, stop it. That doesn't happen. But I think what you said is, if you write it out and you therefore have a kind of purpose to the trade you're taking, it's driven by some sort of analysis, some sort of, you know, making sense of what's going on in the market, of the price action, the news story, the sentiment, the liquidity, all those things come together to form a story in your head, which you then evaluate the risk reward in the market or the liquidity position of the market. And you've got a good reason to take the trade. Whereas the other one was, you know, I lost money, I just need to make it back. That's not a reason.
That's it. That's the worst thing is when you feel like compelled to try and make some money back. And that was also part of the problem for me in 2012. You know, my P&L was going down and down and down. And I was getting more desperate to find a trade to make the money back. And of course, it wasn't going to happen. 2013, though, it was a different story with the Japan trade. And I recovered all those losses.
Brilliant. Well, I realize we're getting towards the end of this podcast, but I do want to ask a question that's on my mind in terms of, where is the trigger point for executing macro? You know, because it seems to be, it's obviously a bigger level of thinking. And compared to short-term trading, where, of course, people get the MACDs crossed or the averages crossed and bang, they're doing something. Where's your point of bang on a macro trade? And have you missed any, or is it a case of, oh, I should have done it halfway through the research sort of thing, rather than waiting to, where I've actually got my conclusion?
Yeah, I mean, I've missed plenty of trades. So there's no question about that. And the point of trigger, I think, is very hard. I think it's got to be a story that's kind of new and different, and market hasn't really moved. The market hasn't priced it in. Like, for example, the recovery from the pandemic, where I at the time felt, this really isn't going to be the end of the world. These shutdowns that we had in 2020, it's not the world will recover. But everything that I read and everything that I researched told me the opposite. And I thought, well, the valuations are okay, maybe there's a chance, but I missed out on getting long the S&P. I really missed out on getting long. I had some smaller positions, PA positions, should we say, in my own, domestic UK stocks, which I don't really touch. And I was fine with those. It's not like I was thinking, oh my God, the world, it's a disaster, I've got to get out of everything. I never thought that. But by the same token, I didn't really get on the recovery trade at all. And if anything, because I'd sort of missed out a large part of the rally in the S&P, I did think, okay, well, it's overvalued. now it's gone too far. I'll try, you know, going against this, which was a mistake. So that's just one example of how very easy to overanalyze stuff and miss something where the market is going to run with it before you've really come to the conclusion that the macro environment has changed. But I'm sure there's numerous others.
I've got one question I have to ask you before you leave, and I think I know the answer. And I know we talked about the pain of that gut-wrenching feeling you get at times in this job. Would you have done anything else?
Absolutely not. I loved being a trader. I still do love what I do. I love, you know, with hindsight, all the experience I had, all the pain from those painful experiences was part of the learning process. And I am where I am now, better for having gone through all that pain. And I think for anyone starting out as a trader now who's new to this, you just have to accept that there is going to be a lot of pain. If you can acknowledge that reasonably early on, you should be in pretty good shape. So, no, I certainly wouldn't have missed out on this.
Mark, anything you want to add?
No, perhaps it's a good time for me to sort of start to sum up some things, really. I think there's some very big messages in here that, you know, it seems simple, but it's super complex. You know, there's lots of different layers of this market that you can be tripped up upon. You can have to deal with various types of emotions that may not be coming from markets, that may be coming from personal sources. That are tripping you up in your journey and becoming inflammation to guess load you with stuff that doesn't give you the capacity to look at the complexity of the market and take advantage of it. And so this having the sense that it's okay to ask for help, having somebody that you can trust that is someone that you can ask for help is really, really important because And that's helped from the sense of learning as much as, to help you on the journey. As we've heard today, we've all been professionals in the space, and we can absolutely say there are times when you think, well, actually, I haven't got a clue what's going on, and actually owning up to that, really important. I've seen so many people that actually just think, God damn, they just don't know what they're doing. But I suppose we all don't know what we're doing at the beginning. And as Johnny said, you learn by kind of getting involved and getting exposed in a very balanced, measured way to kind of just see how something feels, to see if you can cope with it. And perhaps that is the way, just a slow approach into it, testing it out, understanding the breadth of the market. And that's an education in itself, as Johnny said, looking at the specifications of product that are out there for all to see on the major exchanges and being curious about that because there's a hell of a lot going on. And there are many different ways to reflect risk and to reflect trade and be a grand macro trader or maybe a mix of macro and short term. There's various styles out there that can be reflected through many, many different ways into showing up as a trade. So, Johnny, we're delighted that you've dipped into that and also shared some of your own vulnerability of being on that journey as well and the fact that there are times when it's just not easy, but there are some things that are not within our control that maybe we have to sort of step back and think, actually, I'm not in the right mindset to deal with, facing risk and dealing with risk. So perhaps, if I may, Steve, I'd just like to ask Johnny, as we start to end this podcast, A, brilliant. I mean, Johnny, I guess we went everywhere on that and we're so grateful. But, you've talked about writing and creating research. And, of course, that's you do that now as this product. Perhaps as we start to leave you, perhaps if you can just tell us more about what you're doing, where people can find you, how people can subscribe to the very valuable service you're providing.
Well, I think the easiest way to get an idea of what I'm doing is follow me on Twitter. If you search for Super Macro, I think on Twitter it's at super underbar macro, but just type in super macro and hopefully something will come up. You'll find me. That's probably the easiest way. The website is going to be called super-macro.com. And if anybody's interested in getting a subscription to the newsletter, just email me, just email contact@super-macro.com, and I'll add you to the mailing list, and you can have a free subscription for now till we get the website up and running properly. So that's really how to get an idea of the kind of stuff that I'm doing. But I hope to have this website finished. Well, it's not me that's doing it, but I hope the web designers are finished by the end of this month, and then it'll be launched properly.
That's terrific. And I get your tweets and they're brilliant. It's high quality stuff. It's someone who's actually been there, and I think that's the big difference. There's a lot of market commentators out there, very smart, very intelligent, backgrounds in economics or analysis, and I've got a lot of respect for them. But there's something else when the person has actually been the one who takes the risk and is still doing it at the same time.
Just once again, we're delighted that Johnny spared some time for us. It's always good to get a professional on that's had, big bank backgrounds, big investment bank backgrounds, big house backgrounds behind him, and has felt the pain, has lived the journey, and has learned through that journey too, and has frankly, shared that with us. And that's all we want. And that's what we got. So, we're very grateful for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on the show. Honestly, it's been, I can't believe it's been an hour and a half I've been on this, but it's just whizzed by.
Thank you for listening today. We do hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. A huge thank you to the Alpha Mind podcast sponsor, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. Do check them out at their website, technicalanalysts.com, and do explore the home study course. You can find out more about that and the discount you can obtain to take that at alpha-mind.net. That just leaves us to say we look forward to you engaging with us in the future, and do check out our past episodes. Do also explore the AlphaMind newsletter. Just Google that AlphaMind newsletter, or go onto Substack, which is where we publish it. Other than that, we just wish you well and do tune in again. Thank you very much.